Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Maria Carter. The Trump administration is asking colleges to hand over more information on the race of students who apply to their schools. It's a federal effort to root out racial preferences. But higher education experts say the order is misguided and ultimately won't change enrollment decisions at most schools. OPB's Tiffany Kamhai has more in the first of a series of stories from the Northwest News Network on how these shifts are impacting colleges and students.
College hopeful students in Oregon and Washington are more likely than not to find an open seat waiting for them. That's because most schools in the U.S. are open access institutions. They're focused on educating as many students as possible. John Bakkenstedt formerly ran enrollment at Oregon State University.
There's two kinds of admissions offices in the world. Those who deny students they would like to admit, and those who admit students they would prefer to deny.
He says the vast majority of colleges accept over 70% of students who apply. And if you zero in on public colleges in rural areas like Central Washington and Southern Oregon universities, acceptance rates jump even higher.
We admit around 90% of our applicants as far as our undergraduates.
That's Southern Oregon's Assistant Vice President of Enrollment, Zach Olson.
We're a state public regional institution here to serve our region. That's our mission.
Admissions officers say the most important factor in a college application is a student's academic achievement. Erin Hayes leads admissions at the University of Oregon.
Our review process is largely about assessing students for preparation for college. So it's looking deeply at the combination of curriculum and grades, as well as grade trends.
The heavy weight on academics is true for all higher education institutions. The Trump administration is skeptical, though. Federal officials suspect the nation's most selective colleges are giving students of color unfair advantages. But Bakkenstedt says it's difficult to completely divorce race from student performance. Years of federal data show a persistent grade point average gap favoring white students over Black and Hispanic students.
But it's never a matter of this student is Hispanic, so we're going to admit her. That just does not happen in college admissions.
The federal government says the new admissions data will ensure colleges are complying with a 2023 Supreme Court decision that ended race-based affirmative action. Eric Staub oversees admissions at Lewis and Clark College in Portland.
We changed practices in our office to ensure that there wasn't a way where we would be influenced by an applicant's race or ethnicity.
He says colleges like his separate out race when they consider students for admission.
And I would be totally shocked if the hyper-selective institutions didn't do exactly the same thing.
It's only been 2 years since the High Court ended race-conscious admissions, and the initial impact appears limited so far. Selective schools have seen a drop of Black and Hispanic enrollment, but...
That being said, there's a bunch of schools where nothing happened.
That's Princeton University economist Zachary Bleemer.
Ending affirmative action in Nebraska did not change the number of Black and Hispanic students at the University of Nebraska. Everyone could basically go to the University of Nebraska.
He says we often get fixated on admissions at small, elite schools, but most students in the U.S. attend public institutions that enroll thousands more students and drive regional economies. And those in higher ed believe the Trump administration's increased oversight won't turn up anything new.
Admissions offices are working in the student's best interest.
That's Eric Staub again at Lewis and Clark.
In the end, we're not an office of denial, we're an office of admission.
He says the overwhelming majority of colleges in the U.S. want to enroll as many students as possible, no matter their race. I'm Tiffany Kamhai reporting.
The Spokane Tribe of Indians has a new grant to continue its cultural preservation efforts at its language immersion school. But as Owen Henderson reports, this project goes beyond language revitalization.
Ethnobotany is the study of a people's traditional knowledge and customs regarding plants and their uses. Now, the Spokane Tribe is using the practice to create lessons about the plants their elders used for food, medicine, and ceremonies. Spokane Tribal member Kathy Roper says working on this project has already helped her feel more connected to her identity.
learning the language, learning more about the culture, and learning more about the plants, it is really healing. So I think that's kind of like an element that we're putting into our lessons as well, is, you know, our culture and our language really brings us back to who we are as people, brings us back to who we are as Spokaneans.
Some of that knowledge has already trickled into the non-tribal world, like health supplements that use elderberries and wild rose. But Coeur d'Alene tribal member and Spokane tribe curriculum developer Annette Pione says there's knowledge in the archives the tribe won't share.
Because we don't want it commercialized. We believe the commercialization ravages our plants and they get taken over and exploited, and there's no ethical harvesting going on, and we lose areas.
As well as lesson plans for the Incha Espeus Language Immersion School, Pione and the Language and Culture Office are compiling a database of plant locations and uses for tribal staff. But Pione says only a portion of the knowledge will be made public. I'm Owen Henderson reporting.
As immigration enforcement has intensified, some farmers across the Northwest have concerns over staffing. But labor is just one of many issues. NWPV's Johanna Bejarano and Yakima Herald Republic's Olivia Palmer have more.
The apple harvest is underway in the lower Yakima Valley. There have been no workplace raids in the region's fields, but targeted immigration enforcement is happening.
La gente está con el miedo.
That's Giovanni, a farm worker, who said people are scared. Eric Nicholson works with growers and farm workers as a consultant. He says people aren't going out as much because of immigration enforcement fears.
It is having a profound impact on the residents of the Yakima Valley and Columbia Basin right now, even without the experience of the mass deportations that we fear are forthcoming.
John Davani is the president of the Washington State Tree Fruit Association. He says labor is one of the biggest expenses for tree fruit growers, but not the only issue they face. In the orchards, a near-record apple crop had been predicted by the Washington State Tree Fruit Association, but more than 5 million fewer boxes of apples have been picked so far.
Knowing that there's an abundant supply, we'll be more selective about what we pick because we're skeptical that we're going to pay for our expenses or, you know, cover our expenses.
Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced changes to the H-2A program, cutting farmworker wages and allowing growers to deduct housing costs. The H-2A program allows workers from other countries to work in the U.S. seasonally. Nicholson says the changes could affect local workers, too.
There is fear amongst many that there will now be an economic incentive to hire H-2A workers over domestic workers, causing further displacement.
The U.S. Department of Labor estimates that the changes will save farmers more than $2 billion a year. And self-deportations have grown, making it harder for growers to find enough workers. So now, there are concerns about the nation's food supply.
Longer term, things are uncertain. Devani says tree fruit growers are dealing with international trade, water issues, immigration, and wages.
I've heard growers sort of say that, like, if anyone has the credibility to talk about putting people who are undocumented into a legal status, it would be this administration and this president.
Some farm workers groups and industry leaders, like the United Farm Workers Union and Washington Growers League, say the Farm Workforce Modernization Act would be a solution. Edgar Franks is with Familias Unidas por la Justicia. The union, based in Skagit County, has opposed that legislation and other bills that focus on bringing in more foreign workers. They call for amnesty.
If the growers all decided to say stop the deportations, I think the president would really consider it.
Franks says if growers really care about farm workers and their families, it's time to act. I'm Johanna Bejarano.
And I'm Olivia Palmer.
There's only one place in the United States that houses a Benedictine brewery. OPB's Lisa Wood takes us on a visit with the monks who still brew beer in the centuries-old monastic tradition.
Nestled in the trees on the hill above the town of Mount Angel, Oregon, sits Mount Angel Abbey. It was founded in the Willamette Valley in 1882 by Benedictine monks from Switzerland. After a disastrous fire in 1892, they rebuilt on the hilltop. The Abbey is an expansive complex that houses a monastery, a college, a library, a museum, a guesthouse and retreat center. And the reason I'm here, they are the only monastery in the United States with a brewery that still brews in the centuries-old monastic tradition.
Benedictine monks have a really long history in brewing. After the fall of the Roman Empire, with the collapse of Western civilization, there was very little structure left. And the monks became the brewers of the day. Charlemagne used monasteries to kind of put fabric to his empire. They needed beer for themselves because they couldn't drink the water. So for hundreds of years, until the Renaissance, monks were really the commercial brewers of the day.
That's Father Martin. He's the head brewer and general manager of the brewery and St. Michael Taproom. He produces about 230 barrels of beer a year. I asked him how he came to live at Mount Angel.
I was a software engineer for 10 years. I was involved in my local parish, and people started suggesting I be a priest, or they thought I was the priest, and I couldn't get the idea out of my head. The bishop sent me to Mount Angel Seminary. That was my first exposure to monastic life, but it took a few years of discerning to really make that shift. I came in 1995, so it's been 30 years now.
He wasn't a brewer when he came to Mount Angel, but an offer from a neighboring employee changed everything.
I was barely even a beer drinker, but I started brewing because one of our employees knocked on my office door and said she and her husband had some home brewing equipment they were not going to use anymore. Would I be interested in brewing beer? And I couldn't why are you asking me this question? I couldn't fathom. So I thanked her, but no, I have no interest in brewing beer. But that dumb idea stuck in my head. I wrestled with this thought for 1 month, and I went back to her and said, do you still have that? I fell in love with the process, so I just kept reading, and my engineering background certainly helped, and talking to brewers. And that's where we learned how collegial this industry is. People are very willing to share.
He tells me how the rule of Saint Benedict applies to work and craft and how the brewery fits into that.
You could say he permits the artisans of the monastery to pursue their arts, their crafts. But if it becomes a matter of pride, where the monk feels like he's bestowing something on the monastery, then he's no longer to practice that. This is really a spiritual life, not a business life, not an art life. The monk's number one pursuit is his own spiritual growth.
And what about when the monk is able to practice his craft without pride?
Say that you're heading in the right direction and you're producing things that people like, and are helping the monastery, then Saint Benedict lets it take those to market. What he wants to see is that monks price their goods a little bit less than everyone else. So you're not price gouging. There are people who think, well, monks made this, it's special, and they're willing to pay more for it. We're not 6th century Italy here. We want to work market price. That's the economic system we work in.
Father Martin brews beers that are true to the history of the monastic craft.
We gravitate towards Belgian styles. That's what people associate with monastic brewing because of the Belgian Trappists and their famous beers.
When it comes to sourcing ingredients, some come straight from the Abbey.
The hops are all local. In fact, some of them are grown on our land. The biggest ingredient in beer is, of course, water. It's like 95% water. That comes from our own well. I just have to filter it.
Other than the hum of patrons enjoying themselves, the tap room is quiet, and that's by design. There's no music, no TV, just a space for people to gather, socialize, and enjoy the fruits of Father Martin's work.
It's a special feeling when I can be back brewing a batch of beer and I hear the happy roar in the tap room. There's people here enjoying themselves, and I do hope that they're experiencing something unique in our Benedictine tap room.
But before anything can be served, Father Martin adds what he calls their secret ingredient. He blesses the tap room with a prayer and holy water every day.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the opening of the St. Michael tap room. We're going to do the blessing, so please join us.
And Father Martin has one hope for your experience with his beers.
What I really hope is that someone experiences the goodness of God in tasting a good beer.
And the message on Father Martin's beer bottles is pretty simple. Taste and believe. In Mount Angel, Oregon, I'm Lisa Wood.